Thank you very much, Keith, and thank all of you for being here. It seems as if, I think we have a few extra seats. I won't ask any tough questions. People can sit back at the front if they want to. If anybody wants to move, there are a whole bunch of seats. Or standing is good, too. So it's a pleasure to see everybody here. I know we have a somewhat disjoint group of people here today, so I'd like to certainly welcome everybody from the Royal Society, and I'd like to give a special thank you and welcome to Patricia, who I had the pleasure of meeting for the first time last night, and from all of the OECD Diplomatic Corps, Danielle Yonkasi is here. Hello, Danielle. And it's a pleasure to have all of you here. So let me give you a brief sense of the talk today and what I'm going to talk about and why. So I'll give you an overview, which will take up the lion's share of the talk, as to what it is that we have done and why. And I'm going to invert that a little bit, and I'll tell you a little bit of the story of the genesis of the Institute. And so I will actually start with the why, and then tell you a little bit more about the what. Then I'll give you a sense of where we're going. And then lastly, I'll try to speculate, especially given the fact that we have such a disparate audience. It's a higher order speculation because it's presumptuous of me to speculate in the first instance, and it's especially difficult given the fact that we have such a wide-ranging and diverse group of people. But I will speculate nonetheless, because that's what we do here at the Perimeter Institute, speculate. I will speculate on what it might be for you, because I imagine that's something that you would at least like to be thinking about. So, onwards we go. So the origins of the Institute, there's a story I tell, which has the advantage of being sometimes amusing and actually true, about how the Institute started. And some of you might have heard it before, and I won't go into a great deal of detail, because it's a somewhat time-consuming story. And instead, I'll give you a sense of, I guess, the principal characters involved, and certainly at the founding, the only characters involved, which for myself and Mike Lazaridis. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself. Keith gave you a bit of an introduction of me, and I'll tell you aspects of my experiences that I think proved relevant to the development of the Institute. So I studied theoretical physics, and I studied a few other things. And in studying physics, I realized, as everybody does, especially when they're an undergraduate, for example, you like to have these conversations. I'm sure all of you did this when you were undergraduates, about how you would change the world if you were in control of the world. And the university isn't ideal, and things aren't perfect, and the courses seem a bit repetitive, and one is not actually fostering true knowledge and inquiring. In fact, one is fostering a sense of regurgitation and all these sorts of things that people get upset about and excited when they're talking late at night at donut shops in their undergraduate years. And then one goes further and one starts to see all sorts of things that maybe might be improved upon. One starts noticing sociological trends in academia, and that people who might otherwise be motivated to pursue knowledge for the sake of knowledge tailor their agenda to what's topical, to what's current, what's trending, what's hot. A lot of old chestnuts, really deep questions, get swept under the rug because they're too hard. University professors tell their junior colleagues, well, don't worry about that problem. Don't even try to solve that problem until you have tenure. And by the time people have tenure, they've forgotten about the problems, or they're thinking about other things. And so you notice all these things in the natural course of going through an education. And you think, well, that's interesting. You notice the fact that society doesn't seem to pay a great deal of time and attention to scientific issues, despite the fact that it's obvious to anybody with any level of education that one of the things, in fact, the principal thing that separates us from societies millennia ago is our knowledge of science and our knowledge of technology. Certainly, the ancient Greeks had politicians. They had philosophers, they had lawyers, but the technology, of course, is remarkably different. So you notice all these things and you think, isn't it odd that here we are living in the knowledge age, the information age, the high-tech age, all of the rest of these things. And science itself gets so little play in society. It's so poorly treated. Wouldn't it be, and it's so typecast. It's put in these narrow little boxes. Oh, you're a science person, so you're not interested in this or that, or you're just a mathematical person. Or a story I like to tell is that it's completely reasonable to be going into a cocktail party in the year 2006 and be somebody who has a very high-level job. You might be the editor of a national newspaper, or you might be a politician, or you might be the leader of your country, and you can say, well, I'm not really very good at math. Somebody gives you something, and you say, well, I can't really do this calculation. I was never a math person in high school. And that's completely understood, and it's tolerated. Whereas it's not at all tolerated for you to go to a cocktail party where you're surrounded by people of the same level of education and intelligence and say, you know, I was never really a word guy. I never really did that whole letter thing, that word thing. So there's clearly a double standard. There's clearly a sense that there's not an appreciation, there's not a respect, and there's a willingness to pigeonhole people, let alone, of course, an awareness of history and all of the ideas that captivated great minds who made such remarkable contributions on all sides of the spectrum. So these are things one notices, and one shakes one's head, and one says, that's all very well and good, but I have to get a job. Well, this was my perspective, and this is where I came from. I came across Mike Lazaridis because I needed a job. I went back and did my PhD, and after that, I had every intention of reluctantly going back to the real world and trying to make my way. As I said, I was not terribly motivated for a long, peripatetic postdoc-riddled career because I wanted to have a standard of living above that of your average field mouse. And I thought, it's important to go out and try to do something a little different. So I was on my way to Wall Street for mathematical finance, and in a last-ditch effort to stave that off, I wrote to CEOs of various companies because I knew that if I wrote to human resources departments, they'd tell me you're not a software engineer or something like this. Go away. So I wrote to various companies, CEOs of various companies, and I did some research as to some up-and-coming companies, and one of them was Research in Motion that I had actually not heard of despite the fact that I had done my PhD at University of Waterloo. So this was 1999, and only people who were, I think, a little bit in the know knew about Grimm. Blackbird had just been released in early 1999. So I wrote to Mike, and I wrote to him and 20 other people. I also wrote to Jim Balsley, his co-CEO. I had no idea who these people were. Lots of other companies in different places of the world. And I wrote the standard supplicant letter, which is, here I am. I'm a wonderful person. I've got all these great skills. I've got mathematical skills. I've got communicative skills. Please help save me from a lucrative career on Wall Street. And several people responded, but one of them was Mike. And so now we move into some level of speculation, but I know Mike pretty well. So Mike said, well, you can always work at RIM. We're always looking for bright people. But I have something else I'm just thinking about, and we should talk. So what was the something else Mike was thinking about? Well, Mike is, and this is, I think, extremely important for everybody in this room, because I think there are not lots of people like Mike, but there are. That's a category, that's an equivalence class of people, and I think we should try to get into his head a little bit. So, first of all, Mike was impressed. He was impressed at getting a letter from somebody who had a PhD in physics. That's interesting. Not too many business people would necessarily be interested in somebody who has a PhD in physics or have respect for them because they have a PhD in physics. Of course, we all know better that you shouldn't necessarily have respect for anybody who has a PhD in anything, but nonetheless, the fact that he has that as a businessman, respect for that, is different, is interested, and shows he has a tremendous respect for science. He has a respect and a love for science. He has a respect for physics. He's excited about the idea of fundamental physics, of basic research. And he approaches it thusly, or he did in 1999, and still does to a large extent. So here I am, I've worked very hard, I've built up this company, I've become more successful than my wildest dreams, and I find myself in a situation where I have all this money. paper money. Some of it's paper, most of it's paper, but still, this incredible amount of wealth and this ability to do something. I would like to do something with it. And this is the pivotal point. Not so much what he does, but his motivation to do something with the money. The fact that he wants to do something that's important. He wants to be thinking about something which is perhaps underrepresented by society. He is not interested in doing something to buttress his own ego, or to perhaps buy sports franchises or anything like that. He's thinking, what can I do that would really be of value? Knowing that, after all, we can't take it with us. Here is this money, here's this opportunity. So in a philanthropic context, what is it that I can do? And I'll get back to this later, because I think we should be aware of this and we should be thinking about this, not for Mike. Mike's already certainly done his share. He's done arguably more than his share. But there are other people, I think, who exist out there in all sorts of countries in the world that we might want to be thinking about this. So does Mike say, I want to build a physics institute? No, Mike's not a physicist. Mike can't say, I want to be doing superstring theory and quantum gravity and all this sort of thing. Mike thinks to himself, I want to do something interesting. I'm excited about science. I'm excited physics. I get this letter from this guy who seems to be a reasonably interesting guy. Let's talk and let's think what we can do. But at the back of his mind, he's thinking, if things are going in the right direction, if we can do something interesting, that's what I'd like to do. That's what I'd like to do as part of my legacy. This is something that I believe in. So we meet and we talk, and I can go on for probably longer than I should, but just to give you a bit of background. So there's a strange situation where we're meeting in this restaurant, first time I meet Mike. And he's going on about the power of science, that science is wonderful, and possible what basic research might be able to do for communications, and interesting things in quantum mechanics. And I'm thinking, okay, science is wonderful, that's fine, I know this. Where is this all going? Lots of speculation, science fiction-y things, science fiction-y things. But a clear love and a clear passion and a clear excitement at the idea of research, doing something interesting. So we're talking like this for a while. And I'm trying to figure out where this could possibly be going. And after a couple of hours, he turns to me and he says, so are you interested? And I said, interested in what? I don't know what we're talking about. And of course, he should be appreciated, and of course, the scientists in the room will know this, that there is no shortage of individuals in the world who will approach people who have some scientific background and try to convince them that they have a perpetual motion machine in their basement, or they found the secret to the universe on a piece of paper. So you're always a bit leery, but of course, this was completely different. Here there was this individual who was running this company, and I had approached him, and he's talking about all these things, all sorts of possible ideas, and asking me if I'm interested. I don't know what's going on. So then he takes out, we're sitting at this restaurant, don't forget, and he takes a napkin that's in front of him. And he writes a number down on the napkin, and he hands it to me. He says, what do you think of that? And then I realized that we are in the salary negotiation part of this podcast exercise. So I look at this thing, and I think it's some entry-level number. The whole thing is pretty ridiculous. So I say, fine, sure. Whatever, I'm hesitatingly. And I give it back to him, and there's another pause. I turn to him and I say, so what would you like me to do? I'm trying to take this thing somewhat seriously. Would you like me to write reports? Would you like me to think about things? Would you like me to give you essays, compare other plays? I don't know what we're talking about. And he says to me, something which was extremely bizarre, but later I thought was actually quite prescient. He said, I don't want you to do anything. I just want you to think. I said, okay, I can do that. That's what I've been doing for years, in fact. Nobody paid me very well for it. But he said, my experience is, and this is what happened when I founded RIM, things will start spinning out of control quite quickly, and now's your opportunity to think about things. So think. Said, all right. We shook hands, and I left the restaurant, and I phoned my wife. And I said to her, I think I have a job. And she said, as any reasonable person would say, what does that mean? What do you mean you think you have a job? and what about this thing in New York and Wall Street? No, 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 I said, completely different. I met this guy, he gave me a napkin, different story altogether. And she said, so what do you have to do for this job that you have? And I said, I have to think. So it wasn't terribly convincing, and I went back home, and we laughed about that for a while, and then sure enough, Mike's not a stupid guy, and a couple of days later, I get this couriered check, this prorated amount for this pitifully low amount that I so unhesitatingly agreed to without any negotiation, because I didn't know the context, and I thought, oh my God, he's serious, I better start thinking. So I started thinking, and I was living in, so there's a huge controversy now for those of you who are of a more local disposition, you might be aware that I was living in either the beach or the beaches area of Toronto at the time, and I was walking along the boardwalk, and I was thinking, what can we do? And then I started thinking about all these things I was mentioning before that all of us have had. All of us have commented on what could be done, how could we make a difference, how could we maybe try to structure things a little bit differently. What sort of thing might we come up with if we had the opportunity? And I was forced, because of circumstances, to take this seriously. And I recognized I was in this bizarre position. Clearly hadn't earned it in any clear way. But I was in this bizarre position where I had the opportunity to do something which was almost unprecedented. I mean, perhaps the closest example would be what Abraham Flexner, who was the originator of the Institute for Advanced Study, found himself perhaps a similar position, or close to similar, in 1929, 1930, when he founded the Institute for Advanced Study because of the Bamberger fortune. So I was in this bizarre situation. And so I had to be taking these things seriously. So I'll tell you a little bit about the why, but I wanted to tell you about the framework and the precedents. So I mentioned this making a difference. And the interesting thing, and I've talked to other people who are very esteemed members of the scientific community, and they say to me, what's interesting and what's exciting about Perimeter is that because of the circumstances of its origins, we had the opportunity to rethink everything from the beginning. We were forced, in fact, to rethink everything from the beginning, because everything was somewhat unorthodox. So everything from the origins, from the development, from the people, from the dynamics, it gave us the opportunity, it indeed forced us into the opportunity of rethinking everything from the beginning, which sometimes I think is quite healthy. One doesn't want to do it on a daily basis. But every so often, I think it's useful to have that opportunity. And it was all guided from this notion of making a difference. So, and that's still the case. So maybe that's cliche, and maybe that's a homily, but I think that what I want you to take away from it is that what is different about this institution than most institutions that I certainly see is that every day I wake up in the morning and I think, are we successful? How are we successful? How are we getting closer to our goals? How are we actually making a difference? Because I know very well that Perimeter Institute doesn't need to exist. Didn't need to exist. There was no groundswell of support. There were no massive pickets outside Waterloo. We want a theoretical physics institute. We need a theoretical physics institute. None of that. So there's no reason objectively for us to have existed. So how can we actually contribute? How can we contribute to the research culture? How can we contribute to society? How can we actually do something interesting and innovative and different? If you are someone of perhaps a more patriotic persuasion, you might be tempted to fold that into some nationalistic agenda. Well, we want to be the Canadian Institute for Advanced Study, or we want to be the Canadian this or the Canadian that. Personally, my inclinations don't go in that direction. I'm certainly not anti-Canadian, but I don't think it's sufficient to be looking at things from how can we be the Canadian this or the Canadian that for this particular institution. We have an opportunity to think, how can we make a real difference in the overall research culture? How can we actually contribute to the global research effort? Because after all, these things are global, of course, as we all know. So I had the opportunity, in fact, took the opportunity. A board of directors was appointed shortly thereafter. So in the fall of 1999, there was a board of directors that was assembled. And then I talked to the board, and it was resolved that it would be prudent for me to travel to a wide range of places and have a chance to talk to a large number of people, most of whom were in academia, but not all, most of whom were involved in scientific, international scientific efforts, but not all, and talk to people about a wide range of issues, from scientific management to interaction with the surrounding academic community to involvement of students to involvement of the wider community to architecture of the building, the whole nine yards, and get a sense as to what they might recommend, what they think works for them and doesn't work for them, what they might have done differently or might do differently if they had the chance to reinvent the wheel right now. Got a wide variety of opinions. And from those opinions and my own views and the views of the board, I was able to make recommendations, and we were able to tailor a mandate for the Institute, which I'll tell you about in a moment. So the biggest concerns here, as I mentioned, are this notion of flexibility and this notion of being dynamic. One of the few invariants, so it's amusing to talk to all these people because often they contradict one another if you go from place to place, but there are a few invariants that come out. And one of them was, be independent. Because if you're independent, you have the opportunity really to chart your own ship. You have the opportunity to really do something innovative. And you're not going to get hung up in the bureaucracy of established systems and so forth and so on. So this is an opportunity for you to really capitalize on, be independent. But there's a real danger of being an independent research organization. And that is that you become somewhat out of touch. You become perhaps entrenched. You hire a bunch of people and then there's no necessary structural dynamism. And one of the wonderful things, of course, that universities do so well is they have these mechanisms for dynamism. And a large part of that is the student life, the students that come through constantly, the students at an undergraduate level and the students at a graduate level. So I was counseled very strongly, be flexible, keep that independence, but find a way of incorporating students somehow. And also, of course, postdocs, postdoctoral fellows. So that was something that we bore very much in mind. So now let me get to aspects of the mandate. So this is our mission statement, and it's unwieldy, and I know you should never, there are all these PowerPoint rules, you should never put up texts like this with PowerPoint. But in addition to the fact that rules were meant to be broken, this is somewhat useful because I've highlighted in bold, this is just for the sake of this discussion, some of the things that I think are relevant to this notion of making a difference. So there are a couple of things. Is there a pointer somewhere? I'm not sure. So this will water bottle. So the first thing I want to highlight is this notion of both orthodox and unorthodox. So here is an essential ask. Oh, there is. Oh, thanks. Oh, right, right, right. one of the things that one notices is that very often there are these sociological effects, and especially theoretical physics, when you're so far removed from experiment, that you get this happens in all of science, of course, but you get the too narrowing a perspective in terms of what is meritorious and what's worth focusing on. And you want to have a sufficiently wide tent that you incorporate a lot of interesting ideas and you force people to think in a broader fashion. So that's a statement that most people would, I think, unhesitatingly agree with, but of course you have to be very careful. There are a lot of research avenues that are unfashionable because they should be unfashionable, because they're not necessarily the most fruitful or the most productive areas, as we all know. And you don't want to become known as the Wacky Institute or the Institute for Lost Causes or anything like that. So you want to make it very clear that as part of your mandate, you explore a wide variety of scientific issues, that is within your scientific approaches to these fundamental issues, and you have more of an open mind, but you're also critical. And you certainly are not shunning the orthodox approaches that are almost invariably orthodox for very good reason. They're the most promising approaches, but they're not the only game in town. So that's something which is part of our mandate. That's a balance that we're committed to. Another aspect of the balance that we're committed to is this notion between formal and phenomenologically oriented research. So all I mean by that is theoretical physics, foundational theoretical physics, tends to be, in this day and age, in 2006, something which is highly mathematical, highly abstract, and many areas are not subject to easy experimental verification, to put it mildly. So that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be done. It's not that it's not worth pursuing. But you have to make sure at the end of the day that you're not a mathematics institute, you're a physics institute. Well, you don't have to, but I mean, our mandate is we are a physics institute. And so we have to make sure that in addition to areas such as superstring theory and quantum gravity and other areas that are harder to, extremely hard, well, maybe not, we'll see when the LHC goes online, but basically quite hard to verify experimentally, that you also have some feed-in from the real world. So you have some areas where people are paying attention to data and they're paying attention to phenomenology. And so that's a balance that we believe very strongly in incorporating. And then another, I mentioned the inclusion of graduate students, because that was considered so essential to the liveliness of the research institution, to the opportunity to obviously affect the next generation of scientists. And then there's this other thing, this outreach program. So why did we want to do an outreach program? Why do we care about an outreach program? Well, there are all sorts of reasons why we wanted to do that. But at the end of the day, it's important to realize this institute is founded on philanthropy. This institute is founded, it didn't have to exist, as I said before. It's founded on a motivation to communicate to the wider world that these things are important. And we have a hook that other places don't do. I mean, I'm preaching to the converted, I understand, in this room. But many people are frustrated. Why don't people care about science? Why don't people care about these sorts of things? Well, that's obviously an issue that we're all concerned about. But we have a couple of interesting extra hooks that some other institutions don't have, and we're off to a head start, as it were, and that we should use prudently. So the obvious one is we have this major philanthropist who gave a ton of money, his own money, to start this thing. Why? Why would he do that? That causes all sorts of queries in the community at large. Nobody would bat an eye if he had tried to buy the Ottawa Senators, or if he had tried to purchase 10 Caribbean homes or an island or something like that. Why would anybody want to start a theoretical physics institute? What's that all about? Well, that's interesting, you see. And that's a way that one can galvanize interest even further. And we can harness that. Another thing that we recognize that we could do is that very often scientific research organizations, in fact, almost always, scientific research organizations don't have an outreach mandate. They might have outreach conditions imposed on them because granting councils say, we're not getting enough play from this, you guys have to do this, it's in your grants, it's in all the rest of this. But it doesn't come from the roots of the organization. There's no real mandate. It's not that physicists or scientists don't care about these things. Most of them actually do care. But there's no real structural way of engaging. So we thought, hey, we can do something a little bit differently by incorporating this right in our founding mandate, by making this a pillar of the organization. We can do all sorts of interesting things. We have this hook to be able to engage in society that other people won't have. And we have the flexibility and the opportunity to start new programs on top of that. But also, we have a way of making those programs even better because we can leverage the credibility of the fact that we're a fully fledged research institution. We're not just an outreach institution, we're an outreach and research institution. So we can leverage the credibility of the research which is being done right here, as well as the context that we have around the world. So that makes us interesting, and that makes us different. And in addition to that, and this is something that you might find interesting, the fact that we have such a vibrant outreach program actually makes it easier to recruit people. It's not easy. It's never easy. But it makes it easier, because it's something else that you can say, look at these things that we're doing, and that resonates with the idealism of most scientists, because they think that's really cool. And if you say, we have these programs, if you don't have to organize it, you don't have to administer it, but if you want to get in front of high school kids on a regular basis, or you want to participate in a teacher workshop, or you want to be giving a talk at this particular festival, we can arrange that for you. We'd be happy to arrange that for you. And that's a sense of excitement and dynamism in the place which does appeal to a lot of people. So these things actually can work in a virtuous circle, and they do. And that was the idea that we had. And that was, I think, a central aspect of how we're different. So I'm falling behind, as I tend to do, so I will speed up a little bit. So there's something that I call a meta-mandate, which is, notwithstanding all of this, we have to be very, very certain that we're always going forwards, that we're not believing our own press, that we're not saying, oh, we're excellent. Everybody here is associated with an institution or an organization that would profess to be excellent. Right? It's the great you know, logical conundrum that everybody's a center of excellence. And there's excellence everywhere. And well, of course, we all know that there are good people in a lot of different places. But real excellence, the top quality, is not universal. Of course, tautologically, it's not universal. So you can't ever be in a situation where, despite what the press might say, or despite what your own bump might say, or despite anything else, you have to always be very critical, very objective, always be pushing forwards and saying, well, is that really the case? So that's something that take to heart very, very much. So here are some of the things that we've done. That was the why part. Now I'll tell you the what part. So I mentioned that Mike and I met in August of 1999. There was a board that was appointed several months after that. I began to travel a few months after that. We had a public announcement of the Institute in October of 2000. This was a challenging time because, as those for those who remember these things in great detail, the stock market was going up, the stock market was going down, and especially for tech companies like RIM, it was a particularly exciting time. So we had to be very careful about positioning things and so forth. So we had our public announcement in October of 2000. We had the first meeting of our illustrious scientific advisory committee in March. We've had five or six subsequent meetings. We began research operations in this building. So I don't know if you've all been around Waterloo, but this is just a few meters away. It's about 500 meters away from here. This is the old post office building. It's gone through various different incarnations, but it's right on King Street. And that's where we started in October of 2001. We began our first public lecture. Roger Penrose, who's on our advisory committee, gave that talk. For those of you who know him, you will know that Roger is obviously an incredibly brilliant mind. He's also a very, very sweet person, and he tends to have this incredibly enthusiastic following. He gave a talk, and he sold out the University of Waterloo Theatre of the Arts for, I think it was 900 people, or some enormous number of people. And that was certainly a sense where we could understand that the public in this area, but the public at large, was prepared for scientific lectures. We began our in-class student programs in January 2002. We got considerable amount of government support, and I'll talk about government support in a little bit more detail later on, but both in terms of standard and non-standard approaches. So we got a CFI grant, an ORDC, anyway, it doesn't matter what these grants are, but we got both standard and non-standard approaches. We began our monthly public lecture series in October of 2002. When I started doing this, in keeping with the mandate I said before, I said, we're going to run lectures on science and society, and we're going to run them at a monthly frequency. And people said, you're out of your mind. There's no way that you will get any more than maybe 30 people who are coming to lectures in Waterloo, Ontario. After all, the population is only 90,000, 100,000 here in Waterloo. You won't get any more than maybe 30 people who come to these lectures if you run them monthly. And, you know, half of them, well, you'll get a lot of them coming over and over again. So we've been running them now for 4 years. We're getting over 600 people per event every single month. And that, I think, yes, it's a sign that Waterloo is maybe statistically significant. This is an academic town, there's no question about it. And people are engaged, and maybe they're of above average intelligence, education. But I don't think that's the full story. Because the reason why I said we should do this every month is there is empirical evidence out there A Brief History of Time was on the New York bestseller list for years. It was breaking all these records. People want to know. People want to be engaged. If they have the opportunity to be engaged in a way which is non-judgmental, if they have the opportunity of being engaged in a way which is captivating to them, that they can come in and they can participate in a clear way, they will come. People everywhere, people across the world will be interested in these sorts of things. And they are interested. There is evidence that's out there. I mean, Roger's book, I don't know if you've seen Roger's new book. So have you seen The Road to Reality, this book? It's remarkable. I mean, it's over 1,000 pages, I think. And it basically goes from the ambition of the book is to take somebody who is only familiar with fractions and bring them up to all of the fundamental aspects of current theoretical physics research. To say that that's an ambitious undertaking is, I think, putting it rather mildly. And it's not clear who's actually going to go through, how many people are going to go through that book and read it rigorously all the way through. But people buy it. People buy it. People are interested. People participate in it. There's a hunger out there. There's a need out there for this sort of information. And it's not as if we're inventing it. Our job is to tap into it, and our job is to recognize it. Teacher workshops I talk about. So let me go through the milestones a little bit more. So we opened our new building in October of 2004, the building that you've just seen. Let me talk a little bit about these other things that we do. So by outreach, we do the standard sorts of things that you would imagine for outreach. We do scientific talks to students. We do teacher workshops. And we have public lectures on science and society and these sorts of things. I've talked about all of those. But we also do different things. John and others who took you on the tour may have mentioned to you that when the lecture theater was built, it was built with the idea of acoustical performance as well. Because the idea was, not only do we want to be a place that has high-level cultural activities so that we can attract and retain the highest quality researchers, that's certainly true, but we wanted to engage with the public right away. That's why we were so excited with this site. The city wanted to give us four sites to build. This site was the most exciting, because this site, unlike the others that were away in the woods somewhere, was centrally located right in the middle of town, had the park across the way for the Einsteinian contemplative walks and all that sort of thing, but it was right in the middle of all the shops and the cafes, right in the middle here of Waterloo. So not only could our researchers partake of all the things that were there, but we could be a pillar of the community, which is something that we took very seriously. So why music? Well, maybe some of you don't know this, but Waterloo is actually remarkably strong in music, in classical music. That's a competitive advantage that we have. Music and mathematics have a very, very long tradition of going together, and this was something that we could do to demonstrate, again, to bring people in the building and demonstrate that these things shouldn't be subdivided, that science shouldn't be put in a box, that this is all part of the interesting aspects of the human experience, and that we can do high-level cultural activities on a number of different fronts and make for a stimulating atmosphere. So we're very, very pleased by what we've been able to achieve there. We also had a festival. I won't have time to get into that. But we've had very high-level people who've come through, and I'll tell you about those in a minute. Research areas. I haven't gotten into any of the technicalities. But for those of you who are looking at what specifically we do here, and you may have seen some information on this, it's always dangerous to start saying we only do these things. But these are the fundamental areas that we are invested in now and considering investing more strongly in the future. And there's a balance in these particular areas between some of the things I mentioned before. So for example, quantum information theory, quantum computing, particle physics and cosmology give you that phenomenological window. And obviously they're fundamental. String theory, quantum gravity, and foundations of quantum theory, perhaps not so much. There are some areas of quantum gravity that we do deliberately counterpositioned against string theory, which is much more fashionable. These days, we do both of them in keeping with the mandate of orthodox and unorthodox and so forth. So you see some of the things that I was referring to actually instantiated in a more concrete fashion there. Here's a sense of the numbers, and I'll talk about the numbers of where we'd like to go and where we're expecting to go to get to steady state. And one of the things that you've also appreciated as you've gone through the building is you're in this seminar room, there's a seminar room below you, and there's a lecture theater. So the idea is that we could run conferences and programs and workshops using one of the seminar rooms and the lecture theater, and also have one seminar room for in-house activity. So we could run conferences and in-house activities simultaneously. So lots and lots of conferences and workshops, and we're scaling up more. Lots of visitors. Graduate students I mentioned. Interaction with the surrounding academic community. So I won't dwell on this now, but we have an explicit mandate to interact as much as appropriate with the universities and other institutions that surround us. Some of the more obvious ones are the Institute for Quantum Computing, which I'd be happy to talk about in further detail, because that's actually part of a deliberate strategic plan that we have developed here for Waterloo Region. CETA, which is the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics, which is really a jewel, a research jewel in Canada that we're very fortunate to be close to. And we have various programs, the associate and affiliate member program, to engage with the surrounding community. So I'd be happy to talk about those later. Here are some of the outreach programs that we do right now. So this is the International Summer School for Young Physicists, where we take scientists of young, proto-scientists, young students, high school students from across Canada and around the world to the Institute for a week or two at the Institute, in fact, 2 weeks. And they have, they're led by our director of scientific outreach, who talks about all sorts of pedagogy, modern physics, interesting courses that he gives. They have mentorship sessions with their researchers. They work on special projects. And they also get to interact with each other and some of the teachers. Physica Fantastica is an in-school program where Damien and others go into the classroom and give all sorts of special lectures on interesting aspects of physics, and they also try to convey the mind of a physicist and what makes people do this sort of research. As we all know, there's this disconnect often at the high school level where people think that science, the answers are all at the back of the book and it's already been written and they just have to somehow memorize it. And so one of the pivotal aspects of this particular program is to go into the classroom and to convince people that science really isn't like that at all, that it's a human activity and that it's filled with flaws and dynamism and interest and so forth. Teacher workshops are essential because it's great to reach students, but if you can reach one teacher, you're scaling that up enormously. And so our goal is to be a place where we can be working with the teachers, we can be giving them something concrete, we can be responding to their needs, and we can be giving them the opportunity to be working together and meeting other like-minded teachers from across Canada and from around the world to be able to work together and develop interesting programs. So we have a national teacher workshop, which we are soon going to make more international, which is certainly a strong motivating force for us. And we also have regional teacher workshops. I mentioned the public lectures. I won't go into that in any more detail, other than to say that even despite the remarkable numbers of people we're getting, we recognize that even in high-level Waterloo, people might get a little bit tired of constant lectures on technical topics. So the idea is to be mixing it up, different formats, different aspects. So you have the big scientific big shots to talk about their research or things that they think are of widespread public appeal, but you also have a more diverse lineup. You have historians to talk about, well, what really happened in the trial of Galileo? And we had an English professor who came in and talked about the scandal at Bell Labs and what it means for the ethics of science, these sorts of questions. And there are many, many more. And our mandate is, of course, to be as stimulating and diverse as we possibly can. But again, this is something that we can we can leverage the success of the fact that we are a fully-fledged research institution. So if you try to get Ed Witten, for example, to give a public talk, and you're Outreach Institute X in country Y, it's probably going to be difficult. But if you get Ed Witten to give a public talk because you've got some really interesting conference or workshop or activity that's going on that you are a part of, or maybe you're collaborating with other nearby research institutions as well, then it works quite naturally. And so all of these people, Lisa Randall, Anton Zeilinger, Lenny Susskind, Ed Witten, Paul Steinhardt, who's on our advisory committee, as is Scott Tremaine, these are the creme de la creme of scientific minds who we can attract here, at least for some time, because of the scientific aspect of the institute. So I mentioned that the musical program and the artistic and the cultural program, the people that you see here, we were very, very delighted to have the Kronos Quartet, Emmanuel Axe, Beaux-Arts Trio, Bang on a Can, Juilliard String Quartet. These are people who are really the highest level international performers. And that's part of the message that we're sending here, is that we're doing everything at the highest possible level, the highest possible international level, and we can, and it's interesting. And it's, again, not to be unduly presumptuous, but if you're somebody like Emmanuel Axe, this is a little bit different to come to a physics institute to play. So this is somebody who's played at every major concert hall and chamber music hall in the world, and can play anywhere he wants. And he's thinking, this is an interesting thing to do. This is an interesting experience. And after you go and hear a performance of Emmanuel Axe in your 200-seat hall, which I might add you can't do anywhere on planet Earth, you can then go up to the bistro and have a drink with them. And that's interesting. That's different. So we had a very successful open house geared to our public opening. And I mentioned festival. We ran Einstein Fest, which I'd like to just say one or two words about, last fall. So as many of you are aware, 2005 was the International Year of Physics in honor of the 100th anniversary of Einstein's miracle year in 1905. So people were having celebrations all over the world, as one might expect, in keeping with the great legacy of Einstein and the fact that it was the International Year of Physics. So, of course, we were going to do something as well to celebrate it. And we did it in our own way. So, yes, we had lectures and talks and discussions about Einstein the man and what he was like as a person and what he was like as a scientist and what might have motivated him and what his theories mean to the average person. What they act to distill it for the layperson, and how his work is still impactful today. We had all of that. But we did a good deal more than that, because we, again, in keeping with this notion that science is not this isolated activity, we thought, why not broaden it out, and why not look at the times itself? What was the world like in 1905? What was happening in art? What was happening in music? What was happening in literary theory? And so we ran talks and discussions about what was happening, about psychology. So we'd be looking at, we'd have lectures on Freud, we'd have lectures in music and Schoenberg. We ran Steve Martin's play, Picasso at the La Fin de Gilles. We had an interaction with the Art Gallery of Ontario, and we had a Picasso and a Matisse as part of our exhibition, and much, much, much more. And again, yes, being different, but not being different for the sake of being different. Being different in accordance with our mandate, which is to communicate to people science should not be ghettoized. It's an important creative aspect that is fundamentally in keeping with the highest aspirations of the human condition. And in that respect, is no different from art and music and literature. And close to 30,000 people came. So I will speed up. I'd like to say a word on government. So for those of you who are of a more skeptical disposition, you might say this is all very nice, but what's the bottom line and how does this run? And tell us a little bit more about the money.
So I'll tell you a little bit more about the money.
The Institute was founded with a personal philanthropic donation of $120 million, $100 million from Mike Lazaridis, and $20 million, $10 million each from two of his colleagues, Doug Fragan, another principal at RIM, and Jim Balsley, the co-CEO of RIM, Research in Motion. So we began with that, and through a combination of unique grants given by the Government of Ontario and the Government of Canada for operating funds, as well as established programs such as CFI, Canada Foundation for Innovation, which paid for a good fraction of this building that we're in, and the Ontario Research and Development Challenge Fund, and so forth and so on, that totaled $54 million. We were able to have grants that were able to effectively meet, by and large, our operating spend of the Institute. So the philosophy is we take this unprecedented amount of private money, we make sure it's in an endowment, we have careful stewardship, and we manage the money, and we have a partnership with government so that we can use government grants for ongoing operational funding of the Institute so that we can grow the endowment, so that we can have further solvency and financial security down the road. So that's the game plan. And I should say that we are, as some of you might have heard, we were very pleased to hear that the Government of Ontario, in their recent budget, made an additional commitment of $50 million to the Institute to buttress their end of the private public sector partnership to enable us to continue operations into the more distant future, which is exceptionally important. So let me just say a few words about why this is important. Well, it's obviously important because if you want to do all these wonderful things, they cost a lot of money, and you need the resources to be able to do them. You need to have an endowment which is sufficiently strong so that you can attract, not only can you have that stability, but you can attract people at the highest level. Nobody wants to leave their job, it's hard enough getting them to leave their job at Harvard or Princeton or wherever anyway, to come to Perimeter Institute or to come anywhere. But not only do you have to convince them that you're for real and you're different and you're exciting and you're going to do all these wonderful things in terms of research, but you also have to convince them that you're going to be around, that you're solvent, that you have that stability. And that's extremely important for us. But there's something perhaps even more important, because in the early days we thought, well, should we even be getting government funding at all? Maybe we should just be completely independent. And at the end of the day, after much discussion, we thought, no, we want government funding. We need government funding, not only on the financial side to make sure that we can operate, but because it's so important to get that credibility, that partnership from government. As Mike said himself, if I had not had any government, if we weren't able to procure any government funding, wouldn't have mattered how much money I could have thrown $10 billion at this. It would have been labeled by some people one rich man's crazy idea. But by partnering with the Government of Ontario and the Government of Canada, by having that sense of credibility, that has been enormous. And I can say from personal experience, that has been enormous for us in being able to recruit people at the highest possible level. And of course, there's something else. The federal government and the provincial government funds basic research anyway. So had they not partnered with us, it would have actually been sending out rather mixed signals. So I wanted to stress that. Now I'm going to move very quickly into where we're going. So our goals are extremely ambitious. Our goals are to become an internationally dominant force in fundamental theoretical physics research and become the international dominant brand in physics and science outreach. So here are some of the tactics, as I say, as to what we envision. And these are not written in stone, but this is, to some extent, a blueprint, or at least today's version of the blueprint of where we'd like to go. There are some concerns. As you grow and as you expand, and we've already done, I think, quite a bit of that, but as we're going to expand some more, there are some concerns about preserving the uniqueness, the culture, the ambiance of the place. I mentioned these balancing issues on the research side that we have to be concerned with. It's an ongoing concern to constantly make sure that you're in balance. You can tip very easily into orthodoxy. You can tip very easily into flakiness. You can tip very easily into a mathematical institute. It's harder for us probably to tip in the other direction. But you have to be very, very concerned about all these things on an ongoing basis. Outreach. What sort of things do we have in mind and where are we thinking about going? Well, new products. There are all sorts of pedagogical aids we're imagining in our development. DVDs, accompanying teachers' manuals. Our director of scientific outreach calls lessons in a box. So the idea that we could have these self-contained notions of how best maybe to describe some thorny problems in quantum theory and conceptual problems and so forth. Using the website, of course, we all realize that the world is changing remarkably. And by proper use of the website, we can harness that. Perhaps games, that's obviously a burgeoning area. Different programs, and I don't have time to go into all of this, but there's an awful lot that can be done. This is really a wide open field for us, and we're tremendously excited about the idea of positioning ourselves and being able to work also, and this gets back to the point I made earlier, work with government. One of the things I've certainly experienced from my conversations with Danielle and conversations with other people is that it's not just a question of the government giving you money. It's a question of government saying, okay, we want to support your activity and we'd like to help you. We'd like to assist. We'd like to be able to, if you have products that you think are worth exposing to a wider audience, if you have programs, when we first turned what was then the Summer School for Young Physicists into the International Summer School for Young Physicists, I went to Danielle and I said, I'm interested in expanding this. Can you help me? And she said, yes. I'm going to go and I'll organize an event for you where you can talk to members of the diplomatic service, where you can talk to members of the public service for different countries, and you can have a forum to see if they're interested in participating in this new program. So the way I look at it, the government of Canada and the government of Ontario, they're a resource for us. They're an opportunity for us to be able to expand our network as widely as we possibly can. And they have been very, very receptive, for which I am extremely grateful. So there are concerns with outreach as well. So how do we have to make sure that no matter what we do, we maintain our focus. There are a billion things to do. We clearly shouldn't be trying a billion of them. So we have to maintain our focus within outreach. We also have to maintain our focus because we have this balance between being a research institution and an outreach oriented institution, and we don't want to pour all of our manpower and resources into outreach, despite the fact that one could very easily. So these are continuing issues that one has to be concerned about. So, lastly, my higher order speculation of what it might actually mean for you. So, why should you care? In my humble opinion, if you're here from the Royal Society, and you've heard this, you've heard me go on for the better part of an hour, what does this mean for you? Well, first of all, I think it's useful to know. General awareness. I think Perimeter Institute is on the scene, and we're here to stay, and you might have heard about us in the newspapers, or you might have heard about us in different places, and I think it's probably useful to get to spend some, you know, an hour of your life to get some, maybe not. But it might be useful for you to spend an hour of your life getting some sense as to what it is that that we do here and why we do it. Well, I've stressed some of the things that I think have enabled us to be successful, and I've tried to highlight some of the things that I think are worrisome or concerning for us. So we have a clear mandate. We have this notion of recognizing that we don't have to exist, and we have to be critical. We have to be asking ourselves what we're really doing to achieve success. We have to have a clear understanding of what success means. And we've been forced to some extent, reinvent aspects of the landscape and take a fresh look at things. And I think, I know from casual conversation that the Royal Society has gone through some structural changes and is going through some structural changes, which is great. Any organization should do that. And maybe some of the things that we have gone through would be relevant to you. I know that people from the Royal Society have said that they're interested in outreach. They're interested in thinking about reevaluating themselves. They're clearly interested in being international. So that's something which I think would be relevant. One of the things which I like to stress, certainly when I'm speaking to groups of people where there are organizations that are considering various restructuring efforts is, in my judgment, one of the things that's most important is accountability. So we have a very clear structure here at Perimeter Institute, which is that if things screw up, I'm responsible. And I think that works remarkably well. Sometimes it makes my life difficult, but it's very clear that the board knows that here is the mandate of what the Institute is, and here is what we want to achieve. And if we don't achieve it, it's Howard's fault. So we fire Howard, or we hit him with a hockey stick, or we do something like that, right? And there's no passing of the buck. There's none of that. And often in organizations where you see, you know, you have an advisory council, another advisory council, and a committee that reports to this committee, and a, you know, this person who's over there, just as sometimes happens in government, where you have two levels of government that are supposed to be involved in the same, there's this issue of, well, okay, things aren't working the way they should be, but who's to blame? Who's going to fix it? Who do we fire? And I think that's very useful. I think it's useful to have a clear path to who's responsible. Sometimes it's painful, but it's clear, and I think that's useful. So if you are coming from a rather different perspective as part of this OECD diplomatic group, yes, I think it's also interesting for you to know about what Perimeter is. I think I didn't mention so much the linkages with other institutions, but that is something that we're obviously interested in doing when appropriate, and I'd be happy to talk more about that. Something that you should know that we've recently received UNESCO endorsement of the International Summer School for Young Physicists as well as the Einstein Plus program, and so we are a very, although we're Canadian, we're proud to be supported by the Canadian government, we're an international organization, and this is because not only is science on the research side obviously international, but in our view, outreach is international. And we don't look at it from this filter of necessarily aiding Canadian productivity or Canadian competitiveness. Yes, that's nice as a byproduct. But gosh, wouldn't it be wonderful if the whole world became much more scientifically literate? Wouldn't it be wonderful if 5%, if we had 5%, as I like to say, which gets me in trouble sometimes, if we had 5% or maybe even 3% more scientists worldwide and 3% less lawyers? Actually, that's my goal in life. Imagine how the world would change. Imagine the numbers. And then there's this issue of philanthropy. So I've gone on, and I've said, Mike this and Mike that, and Mike's a wonderful person. And that's absolutely true. Mike is a wonderful person, and he's a special person. But I don't think he's special in the sense that he wants to do interesting things with his resources. And there is more than Mike Lazaridis out there in the greater world, not only in Canada, but beyond. There are people who have made fortunes who are motivated to do interesting things if they can find the right vehicle, if they can make sure that the accountability is there, if they can get a sense that it's really making a difference in some ways, if their imagination can be captivated. And I would encourage all of you to be thinking more along these lines, because in my experience, people don't. They instead they say, here is what it is that we're trying to do, and we want to constantly get money for it. So they're pounding on doors and they're trying to get money. Why doesn't anybody give us money? This is a real problem if we only have money. Oh, those Perimeter guys, they're so lucky they have money. Well, there's only one Mike in the world, and so forth, and they go away. That's not the way to look at it. The way to look at it is to say, how can we be doing something which is captivating, sufficiently captivating? How can we have something sexy and interesting and making a difference enough that it would make somebody who had the resources say, yeah, that's a cool thing to do. That's really interesting. That's what I'd like to support. Because people don't want to give money. I mean, you guys don't, right? I mean, we're not, unfortunately, none of us are billionaires. I'm guessing none of us are done. I'm not a billionaire anyway. So, but you're not lining up to give money to everybody who knocks on your door. What you're interested in being captivated by something exciting, something interesting, something new, something different, something that's effective, something that you can guarantee is going to be effective. So, end of speech. And I think that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much.
great presentation. I'm getting ready to talk.
Sure.
I noticed everybody woke up in the front row when he got the signal. We have about time for 15 minutes of questions, and I guess about 10 minutes rather, and then the last person will be on the talk. Question here, and please identify yourself.
My name is Tom Pavidi. I'm the Royal Society, if you don't know the words. Have you thought about inviting critics of the first team here? How about Sir Roger Penrose?
Well, yes and yes. In fact, we have quite a few critics of superstring theory who work in this building. So there are no shortage of those. So we certainly invite, maybe I'm not sure I understand what invite. I mean, Roger is a great example. He is on our advisory committee. He has given lectures here at the Institute on more than one occasion. We're hoping that he will, in fact, participate in, we're thinking about the upcoming conferences and workshops that he might be interested in participating in. So, but let's not talk about Roger per se. Let's take that point a little bit more broadly. There are, in keeping with the mandate of this institute, there are many people who come through here who have a wide variety of critical views of different areas of fundamental physics. The prevailing view in that particular area is supportive of string theory, but there are several people who are not supportive of string theory, and many of them have certainly come through this institute and participated. And that's exactly the sort of culture of lively interchange that we want to have, because it forces people to confront the questions of, well, why? You have a critical thinker who says, well, I don't agree with this, and you have to convince me of that, and how can you support this, and so forth. And the string theorists can and do and justifiably turn around and say, well, that's all very interesting, but what have you got that's so much better, and what would you propose? And this lively give and take does happen, and that's part of the founding mandate.
Okay, let's just see here. Those are almost equal, so we'll take the gentleman from out of town first.
Hi, Commissioner Fork, I had it. Howard, first of all, let me thank you for a very eloquent presentation. Could you tell us in a nutshell, what are the major achievements of the Institute so far?
So, I'll answer your question in several different ways. First, I guess I'll start from the standard, more technical aspect, and then I'll try to bring it out larger. So you tell me if I've answered it completely. So the first way to answer that is, well, what kind of interesting scientific developments have happened since you opened your doors in 2001. And I would say, well, it's a bit early to say, to evaluate us in terms of having a breakthrough. That's perhaps a bit harsh. But I can point to some really interesting, influential papers that have been written, and some ideas, maybe I'll do that, that have been put out into the public forum, the public scientific forum, since we started. So, one of the things we do is quantum information theory. There was a quantum information theorist, Daniel Gottesman, here, who had a very interesting result in fault-tolerant computation. So that was that he worked on with other collaborators, John Fresco at Caltech and somebody else. So that was one result. In string theory, perhaps the more famous result was Rob Myers, who's our leading the senior string theorist, came up with a really interesting idea about possibly finding evidence for string theory in super large cosmic strings. So this was a way of, I guess, looking for a smoking gun. I mentioned the phenomenological difficulties of superstring theory because of the energies involved. But nonetheless, he did two things. He came up with a really interesting idea, and he showed that people could be thinking along these lines, which I think carried a tremendous amount of weight. There are some of our younger string theorists have come up with, so some of these are more technical, and I won't bore you with the technical aspects, but really interesting ideas related to string theory, the landscape, billion field theories, and so forth. One of the people who's leading the group in Foundations of Quantum Theory is coming up with an interesting way to rethink causality and look at causality in terms of the dynamics of quantum theory in terms of quantum gravity. So, these are some of the ideas. I can talk more about some of the other ideas. Are they the biggest? Are they Einstein 1905 ideas? Well, no, that's a pretty tough that's a pretty tough measuring stick. But they're interesting, and they're provocative, and they're unique. So I'm proud of that, and I'm pleased with that, and I think, and there are others, and I think that if you think, here are some of the accomplishments that have happened after only 4 or 5 years, that's pretty good. But I think there's a lot more that you can say, because when you ask just on the research side, and I'll get to the outreach side in a second, how do you measure success? Well, yeah, you've got your standard publications and citations and impact on the community, and these things are important, and you have to pay attention to them. But we do more than that. We have conferences and workshops that are here. So we have people who come in for a week. And we have long-term visitors who are here for years, and maybe they interact. And we have 300, as I mentioned, short-term visitors who come in a year. So how many papers and how many ideas and how many notions are germinated here at the Institute? And then they go off to write interesting papers. It doesn't have to be our faculty, necessarily. Our faculty may have had a word here. How many ideas actually might have been crafted here and might not get written up for another 2 or 3 years? How many people were influenced by a graduate summer school when they came here for 2 weeks? And they had an interesting scientific idea, or they were convinced to be in the field, or they started moving in another direction, and you won't know about that for another 5 or 10 years. So that's very important. That's an essential aspect of our productivity in the long term, because after all, those are our goals. There's another aspect, which is there a real buzz? Is there a real sense of excitement here at the Institute? Is there a buzz in the community? Is there a sense that, hey, the sociological boundaries are actually being taken on? This is a place where, look, my God, a captain of industry gave money for this thing. Maybe science really is important. Maybe if I'm somebody who's thinking about doing a PhD, I won't think about going to Wall Street right away. Okay, so maybe global finance would collapse. That's another issue. But these are real effects. They're hard to quantify, but they're real effects. And then there's a much larger effect, which is what have you done in terms of outreach? What have you done in terms of influencing people? What have you done in terms of motivating everyone from your retired high school teacher to your active high school teacher to your disconsolate high school student to your 8-year-old girl who's living in, you know, anywhere, who's living in Islamabad or who's living in Stockholm or who's living in Winnipeg? That this is really exciting and interesting and cool stuff. That's hard, that's maybe even harder to quantify, but I would argue more important than any of the other things we've said before, because if you can have that sort of impact and that sort of global reach, then you can really change the world.
Okay, I think we'll just take one more question. Please identify yourself again.
Okay, I'm Glenville, University of Waterloo. Listening to your talk, I found there was one word which appeared more often than any other, the word interesting. And it's interesting. It wasn't useful.
That's an interesting question.
It's interesting. So I'm not sure how to answer that, other than just revealing my belief system, as it were, and I think that we, if I could be so arrogant, I think that we, as citizens of planet Earth, would be better off if perhaps we paid more attention to interesting and less attention to useful all the time. If we moved a little bit more towards that part of the balance. I'm not suggesting that we should be ignorant of, or we should be oblivious to, or we should be unconcerning of being useful. I think that's vitally important. But I think one can tip too far in the balance, and I would posit that we actually have.
Okay, yeah, very good. Well, you know, before I give you a final thanks, actually, probably we have a little family history in this land here. Dad's brother Norman Heichel designed and built the hockey arena.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
So I knocked that down.
Thank you for an excellent presentation. We really appreciate your kind hospitality today, and it's not going to stop. We're almost there. And also to the other colleague, John, and others who have made this a fantastic day here at the Turner Institute. Thank you very much.